Hello and welcome to Power Play for this Friday, June 24th, and happy Fête Nationale. I'm Joyce Napier. Coming up on the show, the right to abortion in the U.S. is a thing of the past.
Today's Supreme Court decision in Dobbs is the most important pro-life ruling in American history.
We will not stop fighting.
Voters need to make their voices heard.
The U.S. Supreme Court ends Roe versus Wade, overturning the national right to abortion. Could Canada see a surge of Americans traveling here for abortion services? We get the latest from D.C., then bring in the minister responsible. And hurry up and wait is the summer, is it the summer, rather, of lineups. Canadians face huge waits at hospitals, passport offices and airports. Will patients with this government run out? We ask the strategy session. Plus, can Prince Charles hold the Commonwealth together?
That each member's constitutional arrangement, as republic or monarchy, is purely a matter for each member country to decide.
The future king reaches out to member countries at risk of walking away. CTV's Kevin Gallagher brings us the latest from the summit in Kigali. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players.
This is a moment 50 years in the making. Millions and millions of innocent human beings were lost because of the Roe versus Wade decision, and I'm so glad that the justice is actually established, the justice and the rule of law in this land.
My reaction right now is that the Supreme Court issued an illegitimate fascist ruling.
In Canada, we will always defend women's rights to choose and continue to work to expand access to the full range of reproductive and health and services.
A landmark decision today in the U.S. A Supreme Court overturned the Roe versus Wade ruling 6-3, ending the national right to abortions. The massive shift in women's health was long anticipated, especially after last month's Supreme Court leak of a draft opinion on the case. Now, individual states can legislate on abortions. 13 U.S. states already have so-called trigger laws in place to criminalize abortion once Roe versus Wade was overturned. Those bans could come into effect within 30 days after states certify the Supreme Court's ruling. And large crowds quickly gathered outside the U.S. Supreme Court, some anti-abortion protesters celebrating the ruling just meters away from upset pro-abortion protesters. So for more, let's head to the U.S. Supreme Court, where CTV National News Washington Bureau Chief Joy Malbon is standing by. Joy, always good to see you. I know you were there with those crowds earlier today. We did get a sneak peek at this judgment when that draft was leaked, but it has been a shock in the United States and across the world. What is the reasoning behind this judgment?
You're right, Joyce. We were down at the Supreme Court, and the emotion, the shock, it was like a gut punch rippling through this crowd of demonstrators. Yes, there were celebrations by people who have been fighting for decades against abortion, and also just anger and tears that what was considered a right of American women could be taken away. The reasoning behind the decision is very much like what we learned in that leak back in May. Conservative Justice Samuel Alito said that, look, it's not written in the Constitution that abortion is a right, so it's egregious and wrong. And the liberals were overruled. And you can thank Donald Trump for that, because three of those justices were appointed by Donald Trump. The liberals who were dissenting on the court said, with great sorrow from this court, we dissent. This is wrong. It's just, everybody thought this was going to happen because of the leaked copy from Justice Alito. But the fact that it's actually happened has just been unthinkable. And the anger and the tears and the shock, it was just incredible down there.
And we see pictures as you speak, Joy, we're seeing pictures as the crowds are growing even bigger in front of the Supreme Court. So we know that now it's up to the states to decide, I guess, what they're going to do. But what comes next? I mean, we know the president today said it's a sad day for the court and for the country, a tragic error by the Supreme Court. So first, what can Congress really do now?
Well, that's just it. When this leaked memo came out back in May, the Senate, some of the lawmakers tried to codify abortion rights into federal law. Of course, Democrats did not have the vote, so it did not pass. The president can't issue an executive order to suddenly make it law. And so he's telling everyone, and Democrats are telling everyone, what you have to do is get out there and vote. Make this a ballot box issue when it comes to the midterms. Vote your state legislatures, because what's going to happen now is you're going to have this patchwork of rules. You're going to have half of this country, Republican states, Republican-controlled states, that will issue some kind of restrictive ban on abortion or ban it outright. And some of them are you know, pretty severe. If a doctor is caught performing an abortion, say in Texas, that's considered homicide. They could be put in jail for life. I mean, it's up to individual states, and that is what makes this, you know, so incredibly hard to deal with. Because if you live in, you know, say Oklahoma or Fargo, North Dakota, you'll have no right to an abortion unless you have the money to travel and go to another state that's considered a democratic or safer state, that where abortion would still be legal.
Incredible. Hello, 2022. That's CTV News, Joy Malbon. Thanks. Thanks for joining us. And Joy will have, obviously, a report tonight on CTV National News. But how does this impact Canada? We're in a unique position as America's neighbor. And the three dissenting justices warned American women may need to come to Canada to seek out abortions. Here's part of what they had to say. The challenge for a woman will be to finance a trip, not to New York or California, but to Toronto. So will Canada see an influx of American women coming here to have abortions now outlawed in their own country? And can Canada's healthcare system withstand more people? Let's find out. And joining me now is Minister of Families, Children and Social Development, Karina Gould. Welcome to Power Play, Minister. Always good to have you on the show. So I want to go to Roe versus Wade. Well, I know it's not a big surprise. We had the leaks a few months ago, but it's right here in the dissenting opinion. American women are being told in the dissenting opinion to come to Canada for abortion services. Will Canada allow Americans to access abortion services here in Canada?
Well, look, first of all, Joyce, I mean, I think even if we saw that the leak happened a couple of months ago, it doesn't make today any harder for women in the United States or, quite frankly, women around the world. You know, this decision, I think, sends a chill through all of us. It's really disappointing to see. And, you know, as we talked about previously, we're going to have to like see how this rolls out. Canada is going to continue to be there to support women around the world, as we have been for years. But I think we also have to understand that in the United States, you know, there's going to be American states that are going to legislate quickly, like California and New York, to make sure that abortion is legal and accessible and available in their states. And understanding that, you know, a low-income teenager from Texas, you know, Canada might not be their
absolutely,
first choice.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I understand. I mean, there is a cost attached to that. But a minority of states maybe will have a possibility for women to have abortions. But in this dissenting opinion, again, let me re-ask you the question. They're saying that women may have to come to Toronto. So my question is, you've probably seen that dissenting opinion. Will Canada accept American women here who are looking for abortion services?
Well, that's something that we are discussing. You know, as we talked about, like, you know, we will be there. I think there's, you know, lots of Canadians that want to make sure that women who are seeking abortions can have access to them. There's lots of conversations about, you know, medical abortions versus surgical abortions. We're having conversations about this, and we want to be there for American women. Again, it might not be the first choice because there may be somewhere closer for an American woman to go as opposed to coming all the way up to Canada. But I think this is something that we have to look at seriously. We have to understand what the needs are, and I think we need to be there for women in America.
And how would you manage this? I mean, we already have huge wait times for medical services and, you know, the fewest beds per capita in the OECD. And maybe 500,000 to 700,000 people waiting, you know, in waiting in line for surgeries. And clearly, as you said, Canada wants to do its share, wants to help these American women. How would you manage that?
Well, I think, again, this is a question. A lot of people, when they think about abortions, they think about surgical abortions, but actually medical abortions are, can, depending on what the circumstances in, can be easier to manage, can actually be done from home. You don't necessarily have to come to Canada. But what we also have to consider is what some of these laws in the United States would do. You don't want to be in a situation where a woman who takes a medical abortion and has complications then doesn't go to a hospital for fear of being criminally charged for that. We see that in other countries where that happens. So we need to think very carefully about how we support American women, either here in Canada or in the United States. But this is something that, you know, I think the women's movement and women are reeling from today. And, you know, it's just so devastating. If an American comes to Canada for, you know, medical services, they would have to pay out of pocket because obviously we have a single payer system here in Canada. So we need to do some serious thinking about this. We also need to see how other U.S. states react and respond. But it's really a devastating decision, and it's a really sad day for women in the world.
I can't disagree with you on that. I want to get to another topic and move to passports, because you are the minister also responsible for passport services in this country. Now, you know, as well as everybody else has seen these shots and talked to people who are camping in line. But yesterday on this show, the head of the union representing passport workers said he warned the government that this was coming months ago. The question now is obvious. Why were you not ready?
Well, look, I mean, the situation that we saw in Montreal over the last week was totally unacceptable. But I also just want to say that while there are lines in other places around the country, Montreal was the most acute, extraordinary, particularly since last Thursday. And we've made changes to how that's happening. But when you have 2,000 people lining up outside of three offices, it becomes very overwhelming for the staff, but it's not an excuse. It's totally unacceptable. We did start making changes back in November. We started hiring additional people in January. 600 additional people had been hired. We're in the process of hiring 600 more. It takes about 15 weeks to train a passport officer. The first class of trained officers will be in processing centers on Monday. So those are people that were hired, 3 to 4 months ago. But clearly the response wasn't sufficient for the demand that we received. We knew we were going to receive a surge, but we have more work to do. And clearly, I can, promise Canadians that we are absolutely doing that.
Families, Children and Social Development Minister Carina Gould, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. Have yourself a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And coming up, we take you to Texas, where some of the largest abortion providers have already suspended services. Former State Senator Wendy Davis joins us next. Stay right here with Power Play.
It's cruel. In fact, the court laid out state laws criminalizing abortion that go back to the 1800s as rationale. The court literally taking America back 150 years. This is a sad day for the country, in my view.
And welcome back. A landmark ruling overturned nearly 50 years later by another landmark ruling. But the fallout for abortion rights looks different depending on the states. Take Texas. Texas is one of the 13 states with a trigger law in place. That means Texas can ban abortion within just 30 days of today's Supreme Court decision. Now, both Planned Parenthood and Whole Women's Health already say they have paused abortion services in Texas while they review today's Supreme Court ruling. So, is there a fight left in Texas? Today marks nearly 9 years since our next guest spent 13 hours filibustering against an anti-abortion bill in Texas's state Senate. So, how does she respond to the Supreme Court's overturning Roe versus Wade? Let's find out. Joining me now is former Texas State Senator and Deeds Not Words founder Wendy Davis. Welcome, Senator. Very good to have you on the show. So you've been one of those people fighting for this. How do you feel today, and how do you go forward?
You know, it's a really tough feeling to describe. I have to say, this morning when the opinion came out, my first reaction was, as a mother of two daughters and a grandmother of two granddaughters, rather than as a politician or a reproductive rights activist. Because I understand, as so many other parents and grandparents do around our country, what this means for our daughters and granddaughters, and the fact that they will grow up now in our country with fewer rights than we had. And what I understand from my own personal trajectory, from poverty to ultimately having the privilege of serving in the Texas State Senate, is that reproductive autonomy is such an important part of controlling the destiny of who we become. And when we strip that away from women in states across this country, we are not only harming them and their families and their futures, but we're harming the strength and the fabric of who we are as a country.
So explain this to us, Senator, because Texas has Planned Parenthood and Whole Woman's Health have both already paused abortion services in your state. So what does that mean for women in Texas? And does it mean that other states will be able to have abortions? Is this a blanket national, or will every state have to make that choice in their own legislatures?
So there are 13 states that had trigger laws, and those states have either immediately banned abortion as a result of that trigger law, or like Texas, within 30 days, abortion services have to close down. And I think that Planned Parenthood and Whole Woman's Health closed today out of an abundance of caution, because the failure to act within the law is a criminal violation, and people can literally be incarcerated as a consequence. In addition to those 13 states with trigger laws, there are another 13 states that have indicated their intent to outlaw abortion upon the overturning of Roe v. Wade. So it looks like we will have at least half, if not a little more, of our states here in the United States that will ban abortion in the immediate future. For those that are what we would, I guess, now call safe states or free states, those states will now be, of course, bombarded with people coming from other areas of the country seeking services. We've already experienced this with our adjacent states to Texas, because, as you may know, in September of last year, Texas banned abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy, and that created instantly a dynamic where people were traveling to our bordering states and even beyond, and huge waiting lines, waiting lists, not just for people coming from our state, but for people who lived in those states as well.
So will it be, and I don't have a lot of time left, but I'm just curious, will it be illegal then for a woman to cross a state line and go into what you call a free state?
It's such an excellent question, and I can tell you that that's what's coming next, that the anti-abortion movement is going to do everything they can to criminalize those who help women leave an abortion prohibitive state to one that allows abortions. We also think that a very soon fight to come will be a ban on contraceptive care, on the morning after pill and even on in vitro fertilization, because states like Texas are moving to grant personhood status to an egg from the moment it is fertilized, and it's going to open a huge legal can of worms as a consequence.
And the investigations would probably be extremely complicated. Wendy Davis, former Texas state senator, thank you for this. Thanks for joining us. And coming up, last summer was dominated by vaccines and election speculations. Will the story of this summer be Canadians stuck in lineups? Our Friday strategy session joins next. Stay right here with PowerPoint. And welcome back. Summer is here, yes it is, and Parliament has risen. And Canadians are getting ready to go on vacation. That is, if they can get their passports on time or get on a flight or even afford a vacation in the first place. So what issue will dominate this summer's barbecue circuit? And what topics will fall by the wayside before Parliament returns in the fall? Let's take this to our panel of Friday strategists. Greg McEachran from Proof Strategies leans liberal. Adrian Batra, the Toronto Sun's editor-in-chief, brings the conservative voice. Anne McGrath is the NDP's national director. And Greg Weston from Earnscliffe Strategies has a non-partisan perspective. Thank you for being there. Look at the smiles. Look at those smiles. Thanks for being there. And it is our last show of the season, so I want to look ahead. And I'm going to call it, among other things, the summer of lineups. Airports, Air Canada counters. Let's talk about them. $4.7 billion they got during the pandemic. Just saying. Lineups for passports, backlogs of surgeries. We're up to, what, almost 700,000 people waiting for surgery, 10-hour wait in emergency room. This while province asked the feds to increase health transfers. And let's not forget the 2.5 million people who are waiting in line to immigrate to Canada. So, Greg McEachran, how does the Liberal government defend this?
I would, if I was advising them, I would say this. Don't confuse strength with stubbornness. It's okay to change direction. And I would say see Doug Ford as an example of that. So don't become so entrenched that you don't want to do anything. And I'll tell you, Joyce, you know, as you mentioned, it's the last week for Parliament. I saw some of my friends that are members of Parliament, and it was very evident to me that they are not unaware of the unhappiness out there about service delivery or inflation or wait times, whatever it may be. I would not be surprised that in the coming days you see a fairly big announcement from the government showing that they are listening to this. They wait for the House to rise for the summer break, and then you know they might have a bit of a clearer media runway to kind of make this point. But it's very evident to me that MPs are aware of this. The other challenge, though, is context and getting accurate information. How long were we told that it was the COVID protocols at airports that were holding everything up? Well, how did that turn out? That's not the issue. People have been, you know, sequestered for 2 years, and all of a sudden, everyone wants to travel, and there's a lineup at for the passports. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, the government can say that they're aware of this, but you can see by the lineups that the same thing that I'm dealing with in my industry, or perhaps you are in the media industry, in terms of shortages, is affecting everyone. There is a crankiness out there that belies the fact that we just went through a major pandemic. The government can no longer depend on the forgiveness of people around the pandemic, and they have to show that they're listening.
Interesting. Adrian, you have here a Liberal-leaning strategist who says the Liberals should take their cues from the Conservative Premier of Ontario in being a little bit more flexible. And you know, maybe he has a good point, and he has a good point, but are these lineups going to dominate the season, or will it be cost of living, inflation? Because I think Greg McEachran is right. People are cranky.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I was in the military, Joyce, we had a saying. It was called hurry up and wait. And I think that's really what is sort of going to happen with Canadians all summer long. And I know that our friend Greg said if he was advising the Liberals, perhaps on this issue, he should be advising the Liberals. And I've no doubt that they're watching us right now. So perhaps they'll take a cue from Greg's advice. And I think what's part of what's at issue here is that the industry gave them warning. This is coming. These issues are happening. The challenge is the Liberals chose to do very little, if anything at all. And not only are the issues for those that are planning on traveling going to be waiting, it's also going to be the big dominant factor. For all those MPs that go back into their ridings and they're out for the barbecues, it's going to be the issue of inflation. And so that, you know, Chrystia Freeland, our finance minister, was made a speech last week. It said little to nothing. This is becoming the predominant issue. So it's one thing to wait in line to get a passport. It's another thing if you can afford to go on a trip. But really, it's the wants and the needs of Canadians right now, and the needs are winning out. 7.7% inflation is something that, you know, most of us them haven't seen, and we haven't seen in decades. And so that is what the MPs are going to be hearing on the summer circuit. And that is the message that they're going to have to send back to the Prime Minister's office. Whether or not they listen is another thing. And whether they've come up with some comprehensive strategy that is not only sellable to the public, but affordable, is remains to be seen. And then there's that little issue of a scandal. Just one last thing that I know that the PMO is going to have to be contending with, and that's the latest in the RCMP scandal with the allegations of political interference. So it's not going to be an easy, restful, relaxing summer for certainly Liberal MPs out there on the circuit.
So let me ask you this, Anne McGrath, because they're now they've gone on a 3-month break. Is that too long? I mean, I know they're in their ridings, and but business happens here as well. So is this a time to take a 3-month break from Parliament?
Well, I think you make a really you have a really good point there, Joyce, because they do have to not see this summer as a vacation. This is not a vacation time. There is a lot of work to do. I agree that a lot of Canadians are really, really preoccupied with the cost of living and inflation. And I think the fact that the Bank of Canada and the response has been really a kind of a one-trick pony, just like raise interest rates, which hurts people even more, and that's the only response to this crisis. I think that they should be, the opposition parties have been putting forward other ideas. I don't agree with the ones from the Conservatives, but I do think that they should be open to other ideas besides just that one tool of raising interest rates. The issues around airports, I agree. I also agree. I mean, that doesn't affect everyone, but it does, you know, kind of create this idea that you can't move around the country or outside of the country. Things are not getting done. Important, basic things are not getting done. I'm in Halifax right now. I just left the Halifax airport. I have never seen the Halifax airport with that many people in it in all the years that I've traveled. So, you know, there are real problems that Canadians are facing. And I think that if there is an impression that the government sees this break when Parliament isn't sitting, and that's the difference. Parliament isn't sitting. That doesn't mean it's a vacation. There's a lot to do. This government has an issue, I think, with empathy, as we talked about in the last few weeks, in terms of, you know, understanding how people are feeling, but also a very serious problem with just plain getting things done, implementation. So I think there's a lot of work to do over the summer.
So, Greg Weston, so how do you think... You know, there's so many little things. They're all little things. They're not little things, but so many things that are piling up. What do you think will have legs going into the fall, and whether they can fix this? Something, anything, fix it.
Well, let's go right to the point. It's a really crappy time to be in government. You're looking at a whole lot of things that you didn't create, and really there's no magic fix for them overnight. It's, you know, Canada is not the only place that has lineups at airports. You talk to people who've traveled in Europe, it's pretty much a mess as well. There are things on the government side, passports. I heard an interview the other day that said that 85% of all the people applying for passports now are getting them for the first time, people who have never traveled outside the country before, and there's this sudden rush. Now everybody wants to travel. So, you know, cut them some slack. I think Canadians will cut them some slack for a little bit, but I think the danger, Joyce, for the government is the overall cumulative effect of these things that aren't working, whether they're lineups at the airports or grocery prices keep going up, and nobody seems to be able to do anything. The overall impact of that is going to be a government that doesn't know how to manage things. And that's the most dangerous. Once that sets in, it's almost impossible to show that image. And for Justin Trudeau, who's recognized, is not known and is not seen as a great economic steward, this could be a lot of that anger is going to turn on him if it hasn't already. This could be a very, very hot time on the barbecue, sir.
Okay, so I have a minute left and I want to go around the table. So, Greg Wesson, I'll ask you a question. What one thing are you looking at for in the summer? One thing. Rapid fire.
Inflation, recession, and the third world war. I mean, it's a very, very distraught. I think this is just a summer of discontent. How's that?
Greg McCachran.
Look, it bothers me that the massacre in Nova Scotia is being used the way it is. If there's something wrong there, fine. I'm very close to this. It's part of the province that I'm from. There's a lot of things that came out during that inquiry that people should be paying attention to, that lives were put in danger. I think separately, I think the prime minister needs to reach out. Doesn't mean you have to change staff, but start hearing from different people, communication, focus groups, so that you are testing how what you're saying is going over.
Anne McGrath.
I think that they have to get down to work on some basic things. Like they have a commitment to a dental care program by the end of the year. They have to get the timetable right. They have to get the basics right on that. They have to do something about the cost of living. Like, there isn't one thing. The one thing is implementation. Figure out what is on people's minds, what they care about, what they're worried about, and come up with plans, concrete plans that will make people's lives better.
Adrian Batra, last word to you.
Canadians expect very basic things from their government, and part of that is services. And this government thus far has shown a little to no interest in providing those basic level of service to Canadians. So what we would love to see is some semblance of competence from somebody in that government that comes forward and does provide some real solutions for Canadians in the coming months.
Well, that's it for The Strategist. I have to say goodbye to you for this summer. Greg McCachran, Adrian Batra, Anne McGrath, Greg Weston. You're brilliant. Have yourselves a wonderful summer and see you in September.
Thank you.
Coming up, Prince Charles reaches out to Commonwealth leaders at a meeting in Rwanda today. Is the future of the Commonwealth in jeopardy? CTV News' Kevin Gallagher joins us from Kigali next. Keep watching Power Play.
The Commonwealth contains within it countries that have had constitutional relationships with my family, some that continue to do so, and increasingly those that have had none. I want to say clearly, as I have said before, that each member's constitutional arrangement, as republic or monarchy, is purely a matter for each member country to decide.
And that was Prince Charles at the opening session of the 26th Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Rwanda, reaching out to members who may be considering turning their backs on the Commonwealth of Nations. So what is his pitch and how much support is he getting? Let's find out. And joining me now from Kigali, Rwanda, is CTV National News parliamentary reporter Kevin Gallagher. Hi, Kevin. Good to see you. So Prince Charles addressed Commonwealth nations today, facing the risk that many of them could turn their backs on the monarchy. So what did he have to say, and can he even reverse what may be a trend?
And certainly this is a real crisis that the monarchy is facing, with Barbados, for example, Joyce, already saying, turning their back basically on the Queen, saying they're not having her as the head of state, and becoming a republic. And other countries like Jamaica are looking to follow suit. So there's a bit of an olive branch extended by Prince Charles today, basically saying that, you know, any country that wants to be part of the Commonwealth, it doesn't matter if you're part of the monarchy, you can be a republic and still be part of the big club. And what's important is that there's a unifying force of working together for, you know, global issues like sustainability, climate change, and, you know, improving economic opportunities. The other thing that I'll say here is that Prince Charles made a point of bringing up his trip, recent trip to Canada, and talked about the horrors and some of the really wrongdoings of the British Empire in its colonial possessions. Slavery, of course, being one of the big topics, and the real human rights abuses that took part in, you know, that British Empire period. And he brought up Canada as an example of a country trying to go through a reconciliation process with Indigenous peoples, and a process, he says, that's challenging, difficult, but one that he was very impressed with. And he thinks that's the right approach for the UK, for example, to relate to former African colonies.
Interesting, the prince making a pitch for the Commonwealth. But, you know, Kevin, on these trips, there's always face-to-face meetings between leaders. So who is Prime Minister Trudeau meeting with, and sort of what has he been able to accomplish?
Well, you know, he met with leaders today from Antigua to the leader of Zambia. But really, there was a big focus on Africa. He also met with the African president of the African Union, I should say. And part of that reason is because Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is really trying to convince some of the African nations that are a bit hesitant to condemn the Russian invasion over fears there'll be retaliation for grain exports, you know, to really get behind a more Western-led movement. I mean, the reality here is, Joyce, Western countries are trying to isolate Russia, but, you know, India, China, and many African countries, and also in the Middle East as well, they're less on board with trying to completely isolate Russia, because they like to get Russian exports. They like to do business with Russia, and they like to take Russian military equipment as well. So, you know, the other main meeting here that's important to bring up is one that was delayed yesterday, Joyce, and that was the meeting with Rwandan President Paul Kagame. Now, Prime Minister Trudeau had a bilateral meeting with Mr. Kagame. Now, human rights groups have been basically shouting from the rooftops to have the Commonwealth nations condemn alleged human rights abuses here in Rwanda. There's allegations that the Kagame regime is jailing and torturing political dissidents. So this is something that they wanted to see leaders like Mr. Trudeau call out. I did hear from officials close to that meeting. We couldn't get inside the doors for the discussion, but that, you know, Prime Minister Trudeau wants Rwanda to have more of a respect for human rights. But, you know, whether that is going to make any waves here, it's really not clear. Of course, outside of that meeting, the host country is really being feted by everyone from, you know, smaller island nations to the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Boris Johnson, who really commended the job of the host nation and called Paul Kagame a friend.
Interesting. Yeah. Diplomacy, eh? CTV News, Kevin Gallagher in Kigali, Rwanda, following the Prime Minister. Thanks for that, Kevin. Safe travels.
Good to talk to you.
And coming up, Rachel and Susan are here with their political plays and misplays of the season. Here they are, their smiling faces. Stay with us. We'll be back right after these messages. And welcome back. The House is officially out for summer. MPs rose yesterday, and they won't be back on Parliament Hill until September. So, in a whirlwind political year with a federal election, a freedom convoy, and a war in Europe, to name just a few, what were the biggest political wins and losses of the season? Let's ask the press gallery. Joining me now are CTVnews.ca online politics producer Rachel a yellow. She also writes the Capital Dispatch newsletter, a must read. And Toronto Star columnist Susan Delacourt, also a must read. Welcome to you both on our last show of the season. So all year, you guys have been dishing out plays and misplays of the week. But today, you have to do the plays and misplays of the year. So, Susan, I'm going to start with you. Who gets your political play of the year?
Well, I you know, it's hands down for me, it is the Liberal New Democratic Party deal. I know it. There will be conservatives out there who say this is, you know, the deal with the devil or the coalition of the unwilling. But it, to me, it has changed dynamics on Parliament Hill in ways that we haven't anticipated yet. I think I'm not sure it's going to last the 3 years, they say, but I do know that when a new Conservative leader is chosen in September, we won't be saying, and how soon are we going to an election? I think it's changed the pace. It's changed the substance of what we're covering on the Hill. And it's basically, it gave Justin Trudeau the majority he failed to get last summer. You see, I had to check myself about when the election was. Last summer.
Yeah, I know. It was last summer. It was not even a year ago, actually. I asked that question yesterday. So, Rachel, I mean, you know, as Susan said, you know, people did not give him a majority, and this kind of did give him a majority. What's your take on the deal between the NDP and the Liberals?
I think the big caveat with this is going to be what actually comes of it, other than basically having a de facto majority in the sense of we're not worried about every confidence vote going into an election, is what is actually going to come from this. They've promised a lot of big things, dental care, for example, and we really haven't seen progress on it yet. And this deal has not been in place for long enough that I think Canadians can start asking, okay, when are we going to see all of this real action that the NDP promised in securing through this deal actually come to fruition?
And so let's talk. So we're into the wins here. So we like wins. Let's get your win, Rachel. What is it?
Yeah, so I'm giving my play of the season to Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky, and I'm giving it to him because I think he has been able to, in a way that I think no one else has recently, been able to unify Canadians, or politicians rather, across political divides. In what he's been doing and advocating for his country has brought in partisans together, united against Russia. He's also called for action, policy movements, spending and change, and actually seen that done. I think that's a very notable accomplishment for Zelensky. Obviously, this all coming amid unfathomable loss and devastation for Ukrainians. And him coming out, giving all of these addresses, doing it at a time when he's under incredible stress and personal threat himself, I think gets my play of the season.
And it's interesting, this man used to be an actor who actually played a guy who became a president, Susan. I watched a few of the episodes. Should other leaders take example from him or inspiration from him?
Very definitely, yes. I think, you know, maybe there is a bit of the training there that teaches you to think on your feet. I think he will be remembered for all the reasons and honored for all the reasons that Rachel is saying. But I think one came really early in there is I don't need a ride. I need ammunition. That's somebody you can't rehearse that. His bravery, he's the Churchill of this war, certainly. And it's been dire. It's been horrible, but at risk to himself, as Rachel said, he has emerged as somebody who has managed to unite the world, basically, against Russia.
Against Russia. What is your misplay of the year? We're going from great to not so great now.
This is really not great, and it may be too inside Ottawa for people outside here, but I am giving it to the Ottawa police for their absolutely abysmal handling of the protest, the convoy protest, when it arrived in Ottawa. I think the city is facing a Canada Day here that for the first time in many, many years will not be on the Hill, and the fear of another convoy protest. The city is traumatized by it. I don't really understand to this day what happened there,
what happened?
I think it was the miscalculation underestimation of the convoy protesters and the stakes involved. I say that's misplay of the year's only half done, but I still give it misplay of 2022.
Yep. Yep. What happened? We still don't know what happened. Anyway, Rachel Aiello, what is your misplay? We have a minute left.
I'm giving my misplay to all of the MPs who misused hybrid parliament this past session, from literally bringing debate into the toilet to opting to zooming into parliament from their offices when they're in Ottawa. I think these were the clear examples of why we should think long and hard about this idea of hybrid parliament, the Zoom function, continuing long term. I think it was a bit cynical and a bit suspect the way the Liberals and NDP kind of pushed this agreement through for another full year. And I'm really curious to see how that plays out, given the fact that they predicted that the pandemic is still going to be a problem a year from now. And we'll see if that rationale upholds or if this is really about them wanting to make it permanent. Parliament functioned for decades prior to this, and I think the conversation should be had sooner rather than later about being realistic on scaling this back.
An interesting thing is they don't have to show up for work at all. There's no parameters. This is a hybrid parliament, and they can not show up. Rachel, Susan, thanks for a great season, and we'll see you next season. Have a wonderful summer.
You too.
You too.
And that's your Power Play Day in politics and our Power Play season on the Hill. Before we head off for a short summer hiatus, we need to thank a few people. It takes a village to make television. So thank you to our brilliant Power Play producers, Rachel Swatek, Caroline O'Neill, Sopal Dutch, our crews who make this happen. And we'll also haul heavy equipment, rain, snow, or shine, and our producers in Toronto and those in the control room as well, who are here in my ear giving me a countdown right now, and they tell me to hurry up. And thank you to you, our viewers, for being there, for joining us here on CTV News Channel. We hope you have a safe and happy summer. See you in September.